This is CliffCentral.com.
It's Lady Gaga. Yes, with Perfect Illusion. Lady Gaga. All right, everybody. It is Tuesday morning. It's almost the end of September. We got 3 days of this month left. Why do you go yay? You don't like September?
No, I like progress in life, Gareth.
Oh, you like...
We must not dwell and sit around and stagnate.
Ben, it's not going faster or slower. It's a fairly regular thing this time.
You wouldn't think so, the way you get so surprised by it.
Well, I'm always surprised when I look at the calendar and I suddenly realize, oh my God, there are 3 days left of this month. You know why? Because October, November, and December are gone in the blink of an eye.
Shouldn't those Christmas advertisements have started already, though?
No, it's back to school. The Christmas is already done. They're finished.
I haven't seen any yet.
I haven't.
Because they're finished, guys. Old news.
Oh, okay.
You know how these things go.
Well, get ready for that. But it is, it's looking like a pretty good summer ahead of us, which is always exciting. People are happy to be around in spring. So if you've got a little spring in your step, you know why. You can hear the birds chirping and you see all these animals trying to mate with each other 24/7.
Just like great. Us.
You know, I've got those two ducks who live now, and they live permanently in my pool.
They kind of just made themselves at home.
I saw them this morning. I left my house at, what, 5:15, somewhere around there. The two ducks are having a party in my pool.
Uh-huh. But where are they fouling?
I don't know. I don't know where they go the rest of the time, but they seem to spend all their time there now. So the place is now, there's regular amounts of duck shit everywhere. And
does Carl chase them and bark at them?
No, I haven't even let him out to meet them. I don't want to. I don't want to scare them away. I kind of like the idea of ducks swimming on the surface of my pool when I'm not using it. We just got to find a way to keep it clean.
Meanwhile, poor Carl hasn't had a dump in about 3 months. He's sitting there with his legs crossed going,
yes, how does that work?
There's another part of the garden he can go out into. He doesn't have to interfere with
he's
the ducks.
He's got like a square meter where he's just covered. And he's
would he totally attack the ducks and try and kill them?
No, of course he wouldn't.
I don't think he's a violent or angry or... but, you know, there's instinct.
It wouldn't make him violent or angry. It would just make him a dog. make him a dog.
Well, there we go. Johnny Cash says, nice app. I don't think it's the actual Johnny Cash, though, because I think he's dead. And Dirk says, Ben, please ease up on the football.
Dirk, it's midweek. That's all there is football.
All right. Sipo says, just set me on fire and walk away. Ha, Gareth. Great show, guys. Thank you, Sipo. And Tlantla says, I join the game and I love it. I'm not sure which game that is.
This listening game.
Oh, right. Okay,
of them
great.
Listening to us on Touch Central and Touch Central. I think.
All right. And Harry says, Ben, your interview was great but too short, so we want more of that.
Okay. No, I can carry it on. I definitely can. But I think 52 minutes is... Some people have attention deficit disorders.
And then Ben, Carl says, it was so nice of your brother to call in Boot.
That was not Ben's brother.
We sound so similar. All right. Very good. Lots and lots of messages pouring in. You can call us too if you want to talk to us about what's going on that you want to get into. It could be the big presidential debate last night. It's the largest political event in television history by audience ratings. That's what they're saying. And a tremendous victory, obviously, for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump.
Tremendous.
Tremendous. That's his favorite word. He must have said it 1,000 times in the debate last night. Yeah. But the wisdom is, the conventional wisdom out there at the moment, across all the networks, except for Fox, obviously, is that Hillary really did beat Trump. She appeared more presidential. She challenged him on what his actual plans are, because he doesn't seem to have plans. He bulldozes his way through questions. But who knows?
But, I mean, these polls...
They're so unscientific.
Well, I mean, what do they mean at the end of the day?
Well, here's the problem.
They don't mean anything.
All of this is opinion until the elections.
Yeah.
Until then, it's just a different kind of speculation. And you'll see CNN will speculate a certain way. Fox will speculate another way. MSNBC another way. It's... you can't make sense of this stuff. You've got to figure it out for yourself. And for some people, that's just too much work. All right, Flax, how about you bring us back to earth with one or two important bits of information we may have missed through the course of the day today?
So, a very, very big happy birthday goes out to Lil Wayne.
Oh,
you'll never guess how old he is. I thought he was much older.
How old is he?
He's turned 34 today.
Huh.
I thought he was well into his 40s, maybe early 50s.
So, is he still Lil Wayne?
Still Lil Wayne. So he was talking about how he's releasing a memoir book.
Oh, he's releasing his memoirs and he's in his 30s?
But it's about his time that he spent in prison. It's going to be called Gone Till November. And it's going to be very interesting. It talks about the things he did in prison. Like he had to officiate a gay marriage in prison. Imagine Lil Wayne officiating a marriage in prison.
Sure.
And he also reveals one of the hardest things that happened to him in prison. And this came to a surprise for me. One of the hardest things that happened was when Drake came to visit him. Mm-hmm. And Drake revealed to him that he had slept with his girlfriend. That was his girlfriend at the time. So imagine you're in prison now. Drake's out there. Your girlfriend's out there. And Drake's now slept with your girlfriend.
Drake slept with Lil Wayne's girlfriend. Yeah. Wow. And they still get along.
They still get along because I think I've been reading on about it. I think he slept with her the day before Lil Wayne met her. So I don't think that really counts. Mm. But all the news stories are saying that Drake slept with Lil Wayne's girlfriend. But to be honest, the day before really wasn't his girlfriend.
Hmm.
So that came a bit of a surprise for me.
Oh, yeah. There's a book that you will read from cover to cover.
But imagine having to go like to your boy in prison and be like, listen, there's something I got to say.
Forget about all these great books that are actually out there. You'll read the Lil Wayne one.
I know. It's just something that
you'll
interested in.
You'll go up to that shelf. You will turf aside all the really great literature and you'll go straight for the Lil Wayne memoirs.
There's more to it. I mean, I admire the struggle that these rappers have been to, from Lil Wayne's to 50 Cent.
I don't know that struggle is the appropriate word.
Lil Wayne didn't go to jail because of his political beliefs.
No, he went to jail because of, I think, drug and gun possession.
Right.
Unknowable.
Exactly, yeah. Well, he struggled for his own things, like drug possession and owning a gun. And attention. Let's not forget, he's been working hard all his life for attention.
There's a bit more to Lil Wayne that you guys don't know. I mean, his upbringing. I think his father walked out on him.
Aww. Yeah. That's never happened to anyone.
Look,
poor him.
Lil Wayne is just doing his job as a celebrity. Part of your job description is remaining relevant so that we can
got to write a book.
We can keep talking about you.
The problem is with Lil Wayne's audience, only about 10% of them are literate. So I don't know who's going to buy this book.
See, I always think, would you like to be a big-time celebrity but have that hard struggle at the start of your life or have a good like life and not be a big-time celebrity?
Seems easy to me.
Yeah, the latter.
I don't know.
I can promise you that the second part
of course I'd choose the latter. I'd like the better life.
Way better. And then psychologically, you're not as screwed up. Anyway. All right. Thank you, Flex. Very exciting. So there's a Lil Wayne memoir coming out.
Do we know what it's called, Flex?
What's it called?
It's gonna
be. If you would just call me Weezy.
No.
Sad gangster.
It's called Gone Till November.
Oh,
Michael did tell us that.
Yeah, you did.
Sorry,
I was swept up in the whole story. It just took me by surprise.
Is Wycliffe Jean okay with that title, though?
I don't know who that is.
Pashita just went, ha. Huh. Tell him who Wycliffe Jean is. Fugees. Tell him.
Like, he did a song with Lil Wayne, Sweetest Girl.
Made me do the hula hoop around the gym just to get a pick again. She's a 10.
We're being sucked into the vortex. All right. Thank you very much, Flaxy. Very good. That's what you need to know about Lil Wayne this morning. In fact, that's more than you needed to know about Lil Wayne. Tembeni says, hey, team, I know... That was my attempt at Lil Wayne tribute. Sorry. She says, I now download the podcast and I listen in the evenings. That Durban guy from Thailand sounds so snotty.
What?
There's a dude who's
the
coming.
The guy he was giving Gareth Gears about everything.
Yeah.
About called holding on too long before the call and then...
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah.
It was very difficult.
And then Tembeni wants to know, can we get to listen for free on MTN and WeChat? I just got a sim. Enjoy your day. No. But we are busy talking to all the networks about... you know, this Data Must Fall campaign that we started, that we've inadvertently found ourselves at the helm of. We got to do things about this now. And Vernon says, Mubs's pessimism is so draining. Have you been pessimistic today?
I am the number one pessimist,
so
man.
So draining. Jesus, I'm sorry, Vernon.
How long have you worked with me? I am the number one pessimist in your life.
But now it's draining though, Mubs.
All of a sudden.
It's just become draining.
Well, I mean, Vernon, I'm sorry.
Vernon.
How dare you?
I don't
dare you?
I don't know how else to be, Vernon. So I'm.
She is what she is.
I mean,
Vernon, you don't have to date her.
You could think that my buddy thinks your expectations are draining as well.
Right. How about you? How about you both just find the middle ground somewhere?
Vernon, you know what? It's part of life. We all have to deal with different types of people, and that's just the way it goes.
Why don't we try and make ourselves feel a little bit better, and we listen to Mabali singing a song? How about that?
I mean, that's really draining.
Humor. She's a giggle at her funeral.
This might be depressing too.
Everybody's disapproval.
Let's give it a try.
Should have worshipped her sooner. If the heavens ever did speak, she's the last true mouthpiece. Every Sunday's getting more bleak. A fresh poison each week.
That's right.
We were sick, born sick. You heard them say it. My church offers no absolutes. She tells me worship in the bedroom. The only heaven I'll be sent to is when I'm alone with you.
I was born. Wait for the chorus. Here it is.
But I love it. Command me to be well.
Amen.
Amen.
That's it.
Amen.
Amen. God.
Amen.
That's it. Take me to church.
I'll work like a dog at the shrine of your lies. I'll tell you my sins, and you can sharpen your knife.
Okay, Marianne Tom coming up next. Girls, we run this mother. Sorry, Mabs. Can't resist. People ask for it all the time. So. Here's some Beyonce for you. Bright and early on a Tuesday. We run this mother. That's about my quota of Beyonce for the morning. In fact, that's my quota of Beyonce for the year.
I have the impression with Beyonce's music, it's like when you're rich and you obviously your kids don't want to do normal jobs, they want to be pop stars.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, honey, what do you want to do? I'm a singer. And then you get home and then she shouts at you like that and you go, oh, this is terrible. Oh, this is such
cuck.
But I've got to tell her it's good. It's like her whole life people have been saying, Beyonce, this is really good.
Listen to this.
Girls times 50, carry on.
Loop. Shocking, right?
Around the world, loop. Everything I've just said, loop.
So you love it, Ben?
I just think all her music is just contrived and desperate.
Oh!
Except for Crazy in Love, because Jay-Z had a hand there.
Okay,
look, just say you're not a fan.
There's a whole beehive that are going to start stinging and attacking
it's
you.
It's not about being a fan. It's about analyzing music, because that's what we do in this world.
How superior.
I'm going to slash your tire.
Here we go.
We have music on our show now. What do you want to do? Just link it like Alex J.
Before we move on, Temba says, guys, everything Black Coffee touches is a hit.
It's
very important.
Yep.
A good story.
You're onto something there.
All right. Everybody, it's very exciting. I'm finally sitting opposite Marianne Tam. I've been waiting for this for a long, long time, and she's here with her book. It is called Hitler, Favut, Mandela, and Me, a memoir of sorts. Well, you look like even you didn't choose that title.
I did. It popped. It was going to be called Whatever Happened to the Finkelsteins, but that was a bit obscure because that was a conversation I had with my Nazi father.
It's a good question, though.
So you say your dad was a Nazi. I mean, I was going to say I wasn't sure how to approach it because I was going to say, so your dad was a Nazi, but then I suddenly thought, no, but hang on. He was in the Luftwaffe and he was born in Nazi Germany.
Yes. So he was like white South Africans born in apartheid South Africa.
Right.
So his entire sort of internal architecture was shaped by, I suppose, the politics around him at the time, which was Adolf Hitler.
Right.
He knew nothing else. But it's interesting because Adolf Hitler took 12 years to destroy Germany. Didn't take long. Took the Nats a bit longer. So, you know, it was difficult to put Mandela in that title, but there's a sort of progression from two fascists to my own liberation. And that's kind of what the book's about. I hated the 20th century with a passion. I just like thought, what is going on here, people? And I kept asking questions and everyone just said, that's the way it is. We smoke in the car with the windows up. Yeah. We chase black people off verges. Women, my dad said, you must become a hairdresser.
We put up this revolting architecture and called it architecture.
Yeah, and why do you want to study? You're a girl. You're going to get married and have kids. I was going like, me? People?
Remember
your place.
It was very important that people remembered their place. And for the longest time in human history, that's been what it is. And if anything, you're a rebel.
Well, I mean, yeah, I suppose so. Because when you get told, you said it gives me a kind of that much understanding of what it must be like to be black in a certain way. Like, not, you know, just because you get told this is what you are and who you are and where you must be and where you must go. Yeah. And sorry, that's our decision. And you're going, but hey.
And God forbid, it's bad enough you get told that by white people, and particularly white men, but then you also get told that by other black people who want you to be in a certain position.
Listen, you know, the degrees of what everybody wants to tell you what to do. And I just kind of thought, well, I want to check out here. I'm just going to smoke weed and listen to Bob Marley, my man, because there's no ANC cell in my neighborhood in Pretoria, and this stuff's not looking good to me. And I've got this Portuguese mother who's illiterate, who just loves me lots and thinks I'm fabulous, and this German father who's undermining. I'm just going to wait for this all to blow over. And it did.
Well, your mom was right. She did love you lots, and you were fabulous, and you've turned into the most fabulous writer. And
thank you.
I look forward to everything that you write, and I regularly check in on the stuff you do in the Daily Maverick.
Thank you.
Because it's insightful, and it's smart, and it's witty, and it's clever, and it's all of those things. And afterwards, I just feel like I've contributed to an improvement in myself by the time I finished an article of yours.
Sure. Well, listen, I hate writing. I wish I was a plumber or something else, because every time I got that blank screen, I think, why?
What am I going to do
doing
now?
This? Yeah. So in many ways, I think the writing, and I've got so many books at home, my kids are like furious. I think I'm going to die under a pile of books. The shelves are going to come off the wall sometime. And I'm wondering how much of that is my mom's own ambition for my brother and I, because she wasn't educated and couldn't read. So I think I'm kind of manifesting something physically.
But it also could be part of that German
possibly
desire for collecting everything and
possibly
and keeping everything in order.
I have to own the German in me.
Yeah.
So like I wake up one in the morning and I want to take over the world, and then the other part of me says, nah, open a shop. Just sell some one-ply toilet paper.
This is great. We're going into the stereotypes straight away.
Yes, no, look, you have to. You know, I mean, kind of, I grew up with the stereotypes and I know them. And when I walk into a Portuguese shop, I know what's going on there. Because, you know, why are you selling wilted bananas, you know, for like separate and one-ply toilet paper in a three-ply neighborhood? Get with the plan. You know, the Portuguese arrived in Angola.
Yes.
Okay. Now, Angola supplies more oil to the United States than Kuwait.
Right.
Do you think they drilled to find the oil? Mm-mm. They opened shops. They got married. They had kids. There's no drilling. What do you talk, drilling?
Why drilling? Too much work.
No, not drilling.
We do shops.
And so, you know, you kind of just get by. We were the Amakwerekwere of the you know, like Park Town, Pretoria in the 1960s. We were the immigrant kids that those Buddha kind of hated.
All right, let's just get stuck into this.
Let's
because
get stuck in.
This is the first time you've really written about your own life.
Mm.
You've always written about macro issues.
Mm, and I would prefer to keep doing that.
But what made you do this? Did the publisher prevail upon you?
I'll tell you what happened. I mean, I'm a scientific rationalist. I don't believe in any religion or like the universe is indifferent.
We're going to get on really well.
Yeah, the universe could not give a toss about anything. No, so you just get on with it. But what happened is I've got a very, very dear friend in Belgium. He's a Belgian writer called Tom Lanois, who I absolutely adore. And I met him a long time ago. And, you know, there's some people in life who just like soul brothers, that's it.
Right.
And he lives off writing in Europe. There are only like 2 million Flemish speaking people, but shit, they must buy books because he's like really, you know, successful. South Africa, you sell 600 books and you're like a bestseller. Like, yeah.
Right.
Anyway, he won a literary prize. He's known me for 25, 30 years. And he, you know, when you get to know somebody outside of their, I suppose, their public persona, I mean, my work is, if I wasn't a pollster, I'd be known by all the other pollsters. It's just my work, you know, because you see my byline, so you think, oh, it's Marion Dam, but it's just my job. But he knows me. And he said, listen, you need to write this story because as a European, he could find the links, the political links to then and now. And he finds South Africa incredible in terms of what we've been able to achieve and how we've exploded the notions of identity and how we fight and how we're moving towards something different, which is not happening in Europe. Europe is shutting down.
Yeah.
And Europe's history is quite bloody, and it's one of nationalism and it's one of murder. 55 million people died. So he flew down one December, took me to dinner at La Perla, which I hate in Cape Town. He doesn't know that. I cannot handle expensive restaurants. I get nervous in them. I don't like the food. I want Pronutro. You know, I mean, like, I'm really, I don't understand. Just something I can put in here and move on. I'm like a Philistine, a total Philistine. So he came and said, listen, I've won this prize and I think you need a few months off to write your book. And I said to him, you're out of your mind. There's like stuff happening, you know. I don't know what's going on in the country, but it's going on and I'm in the middle of it.
Yeah.
So he said, look, it's there. I don't need it. And So when you need that, you know, that's never happened to me before. I work in a really highly abusive industry, you know, yeah, and I don't really care.
And you don't get paid a lot.
No, and I've invited the wolf at the door into my home. The wolf is at my kitchen table. It's been there for a long time. So I'm not scared of that, you know what I mean? And I can always pole dance, and I can go and...
Is that still on the agenda?
Yeah, I suppose so. For aging lesbian mothers at Mavericks tonight, all ladies pole dancing to Barry Manilow. Like, hugely sexy. So, okay, so I left that there and walked out and tried to sort of internalize the magnitude of that gift because it was quite incredible. And then Murray LaVita interviewed me for Die Burger, for the Daily Maverick collection, Brain Porn.
Correct.
And we spoke for about 5 hours, and then he went away, and I thought we'd finish the interview because I know Murray. But he spoke to me about my father and when my father died and kind of this relationship I had with him, which, you know, endured over 30, 40 years, where I refused to not talk about being German, the Holocaust, being here, being white, all sorts of things.
Things that he would rather if you pushed under the carpet.
Yeah, or not talk about, or hadn't had the opportunity to talk about, because he left Germany after the war, went to England, was a prisoner of war, and then came here. So I think post-war
Germans... He was captured it on him, right?
He was captured it on and loved the English. But my father didn't go through a denazification process, which most of the Germans in Germany did. They were taken into the concentration camps to see what they did. So my dad didn't have that. So I'm not quite sure what residual stuff was in his head. And I identified him not as a person, not as an individual, but as part of a mass, which is what I think white South Africans will be identified as, and just get over it, suck it up. Because until you prove yourself not to be part of that, you're going to be part of it. And that's your burden. History comes with its... It comes with the burdens you have to carry. You're not divorced from it.
Own it, and then you can start to progress.
And unpack how much of you is you, and how much of you is history, religion, culture, everything someone else tells you that you are. So you can only do that when you're past 50, you know, if you make it past 50.
Absolutely.
Before then, you're busy with doing, you're having fun, as I did, you know. So anyway, so this thing appears in the newspaper, and a publisher phones me and says, this story I want. So I thought it would be very churlish. Not at this point. Have a look at the two signs on the road. One, someone said, here's some bucks, write a story. It's like unheard of.
Mm.
And second, the publisher phones and says, we want this story.
Yeah.
And so I said, okay, well, let me, you know, the least I can do is try and just see. I don't know what it's going to be.
Did you do this between writing all your columns and everything else?
Well, I didn't want to work for the Daily Maverick while I was doing that because I know how corrosive it is and how all-consuming it is. It's like a 12-hour day. It's you know, investment banker hours with rock drill operator pay. But I said to Branko, listen, I want to just take 4 months off. It's not going to be difficult to do because it's my life, and I think all of us must do that. Go back and reassess our relationships with because you make it right. You can set something in stone and be a victim about a parent or a slight that happened in a playground when you were three that you're carrying for the rest of your life. And Branko said, no, I want you to write. And I said, there's 600 unemployed journalists, you know, just employ someone else. And he said, no, I want you to keep your hand in. So it was quite nice. But every now and again, I had to step out. And then in December, shit hit the fan because Des' weekend special arrived. And I was busy listening to classical music, reading. My children were practicing piano outside. Mm. It was very Chekhovian, very beautiful. Mother was writing in her woman cave with my big poster of Bob Marley. And I get a phone call from Branko, who, you know, I think...
You're talking about the whole Nhlanhla Nene thing. And
I mean, like, I was very happy delving into my past and, you know, coming up with sort of what does this all mean. And the phone rang, and it was Branko. It's Purley Joubert, affidavit, something. And I was like, what? Branko, where? And, you know, from that moment onwards, I've just been...
consumed in the story.
Absolutely.
And well, it is such
all of us have. All of us have.
Well, we are all paying the price for it too. Yeah. Every day it costs us.
And it's unfolding as we speak. And it's, what it's done is it's revealed the game plan, but we don't quite know what the counter game plan is. So we're kind of doing it on the hoof.
Yeah.
So Pravin arrived back in, and that changed where that was going. And now suddenly we see all these people placed in key positions who are there to guard one man. And they
are falling down in dribs and drabs.
Well, eventually the court gets them, as they did to Claudia. Absolutely.
We've got Claudia.
Yes.
You know, they're starting to fall. And when they fall hard because they can't really find anything else to do after that. So that the price of being an acolyte, the price of being a disciple of President Zuma at the moment is that you may end up with absolutely nothing at the end of
this. I think that was the game plan that you're going to go down with him. I mean, sick of fancy phrase the mind. And I think there are people who wouldn't be able to work outside of that patronage network who are going to go down with him, but hoping that the courts aren't going to stop that. And Stephen Groote just said a very interesting thing he said last week or the week before. I mean, time just collapses.
Sure.
That through all these court cases, we set these precedents, and so things happen quicker. So because of Claudi and because of Nkandla, we now know that, you know, what the public protector says goes.
Right.
There's no more fighting that. So each court case, each time they delay it through challenging it through courts, we actually have then a legal precedent that gets set.
It speeds
the next
up.
Absolutely.
Everything.
So the fall, we don't know how it's going to happen, when it's going to happen, and you start looking at who emerges from the background, who's got the money, why is it happening? And there is no one mind behind this. It's what happened with the Nats. Crony capitalism and patronage was a complete feature of the apartheid government.
Yeah, the Bruderbond, all of that stuff, right?
And Neil Barnard played there was an interesting thing that President Zuma did in 2010 in his State of the Nation speech, if you go back and read it. He thanked Neil Barnard. Why? Why would you thank Neil Barnard out of the blue? For what?
What does that mean?
Well, I think there are links. I think there's a way of viewing how the state works or should work.
Old apartheid era Neil Barnard.
Absolutely. And actually, I'm reading Helen Ziller's book at the moment, which I'll be launching, and it's quite interesting what she says about Neil Barnard's incredible power around the previous government and how deep the security apparatus goes.
Tell us about him.
Well, he essentially organized the talks between Mandela and de Klerk, and was three steps ahead of all the politicians. They maneuver behind the scenes and know where the threats are.
So he was like a super strategist.
A complete super strategist, super spy. I mean, listening into people's phone calls, grabbers that can, you know, so if you read his own book, you'll get his version of it. You'll never get the truth of it. But there are people who are co-opted. There are people with not only small Anyala skeletons, but big Anyala skeletons. And when you have skeletons and when they're going to be revealed. So at the moment, when you listen to what Pravin Gordhan says, yesterday he was talking about Democrats, people defending the freedoms, that the people stealing the money from the poor are the counter-revolutionaries. Listen to what's the dog whistle politics. What's between the lines? Robert McBride has been sidelined. Anwar Dramat has been sidelined. A lot of MK cadres and soldiers, really good people.
And a lot of these people actually served under Jacob Zuma.
Absolutely.
When he was the head of intelligence.
Yes. And they're not compromising. I mean, Robert McBride has called the Hawks the Gestapo wing of, you know, or the crimes against the state unit as the Gestapo wing of the Hawks. Listen to what people are saying. So it doesn't, you know, it doesn't mean this has got no ideology behind it. It's happened in Italy.
Yeah.
Same thing happened in Italy. You know, this is what a post-ideological age is about. It's about crony capitalism and getting rich and feeding at the trough.
I want to talk to you above all, because there's such a thing that has crept up in the last while that it's quite nebulous. It's difficult to get my head around. But identity politics is a very big part of our political environment right now. It colors and changes and contrasts a lot of the circumstances in a very, very different way to anything that's ever happened before. And identity politics, obviously, in going back into your history, which we'll touch on in a moment or two, you've had to figure out who you are. And identity politics is all about what groups you belong to, right? And how belonging to those groups is probably a more important part of the definition than your individuality. And you've broken, I said earlier, you're a rebel. You've broken a lot of these rules. I mean, you're not part of your dad's group. You know, you're not a Nazi.
But one thing I am, yes, that overrode all the other groups that I might have been, that were marginal, a gay woman, yeah, growing up in a very patriarchal, oppressive society, is I'm white.
Mm-hmm.
And often I wonder, who would I be without the affirmative action that was there? I mean, I could walk into the bank at the age of 18, 19 and get a loan and buy an apartment because I'm white. Mm. So I don't underestimate how much that benefited me.
Sure.
I can't change it. I can't give back what I have, but no, I need to be aware of that power balance. I also describe in the book, at a certain point when I'm walking along the Seapoint beachfront with my girlfriend and this guy attacks me because he sees me. She grabs my hand and I say, don't do that, because there's a group of hostile men. And they targeted me. They came at me because she had long hair. I mean, all their stereotypes happened. And this guy walked next to me and he kept on saying, what are you, a man, woman, a man, woman? So I stopped and I thought, how am I going to deal with this? And I knew how it would play out. And I said to him, listen, this shtick of yours ain't working with me. Because look at you. You're drunk, aggressive, and toothless. And check my girlfriend. She's like pretty cute, eh? And I knew that he'd look at her and go, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, like, so the wires in his head, like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. But I knew I'd win that argument because I'm a white woman and he was a black man. And the power balance in that moment, I was going to make it go my way because sure. I was able to do that because of a sense of agency that I have as a white person. Sure. So I don't think identity politics are a bad thing.
No. I'm curious as to how you see them playing out from now on. I mean, a lot of what we're seeing in the world around Hillary and Donald, around, you know, Brexit, they're in Vladimir Putin.
Yeah.
Even Jacob Zuma, there's this archetypal male stereotype which almost represents the old world. Mm. Even though he may be a black man in some places, he may be KGB in some places, he may be an orange-faced orangutan in other places. Mm. But it's an archetypal male character that plays in this screenplay we've got going on at the moment. But there's a new kind of character that's coming to the fore. And it's someone who embraces the identity politics, for good or for bad, and uses those to their advantage.
And I think it's a global issue, the identity politics. Europe is shutting down around identity politics and mm-hmm. the Islamophobia and sort of where movement needs to happen. But what I always feel about South Africans is that the conversation is dynamic. Mm. We really fight and shout at each other. The one ism we will work through. We feminism was something that blew over from North America. It's not quite organic to South Africa.
No.
And it's going to get there in its own way as young women today sort of challenge hoteps and all sorts of other things. I love the kind of conversation that's happening. It's just like if you come from the 20th century where I come from, it's like wow, every minute is thrilling in the 21st century, and this country in particular, because white South Africans are a minority, and it's really interesting to be challenged around a worldview and a way of understanding. And I suddenly understood, you know, Slaughtering to Your Ancestors, that book is my slaughtering to my ancestors, and acknowledging the role they play in your life, whether you believe they can mediate or not mediate. So I've learned a lot and absorbed a lot about living in this country where I'm a minority, and there's a lot of really amazing stuff that I can benefit from. So it becomes negative when you actually start saying to somebody that you need to be excluded because of what you are.
Right.
But when it is a window or a door into a conversation about what makes us us. So I'm Marianne, the journalist, the mother, the woman, the white woman, the gay woman, the older woman, because that's the other thing. The other
ageism.
Absolutely, the intersectional mm-hmm. part of the struggle that we
and
don't look at.
Ageism comes down a lot harder on women than men.
Completely. I mean, in a way, if it wasn't for Branko, I wouldn't be working as a journalist because I'm past my sell-by date, which is also okay. Because that's the way the world works. You need younger people to do stuff. But I'd love to train. I'd love to mentor. But there is no space for that.
Mm.
But it doesn't matter because I can make my way. I've got a sense of agency.
But identity politics isn't new. Because
no,
I read this conversation that you had with your dad about immigrants in Germany.
Mm.
And he had a major problem with Turks going into Germany. And you said, well, if you went to Turkey, would you have to change yourself to become a Muslim and speak Turkish?
Yeah.
And he said, no, of course not. Why would I do that?
Yeah.
And you actually write it in his, why would I do that?
Yes.
And then you say to him, you think Germans are superior. That's an identity political
Absolutely.
Position,
Absolutely.
Right? You think the West is superior and everyone should want to be German or British or American.
Mm.
And this is what a lot of white South Africans don't understand. It's like there's because it's assumed and it's conventional wisdom for now or for the last 100 years, it's not regarded as a bad thing.
Mm.
If it was suddenly, imagine black superiority, if there could exist such a thing in tandem with white superiority, it would immediately be regarded as a kind of racism. But white superiority is not.
Well, I think white
for
people,
so many people, it's just the way they grew up.
Yeah, white identity is a default position. And raising two young black women, I was made incredibly aware at the very beginning of just how I had to mediate almost everything that came at them. Disney movies, American television, everything that comes at them is American and is very specific. So they complain about it because I always say, well, you're not going to go and get like drunk at Forries when you're 18 and drink so much because that's not our culture. We don't bribe, that's not our culture. I just need my children to locate themselves in Africa, and I need us to find ways of being that embrace so many things I've seen about being here. here that are not American or European. And I happen to be accidentally popped out in England. So I'm entitled to a British passport, which I don't have. I don't want it.
Yeah.
I'm not English. I went to England.
Oh, most white South Africans would rush to have a British passport.
They can
have
it. They can have my right. British passport. I do not want
not
it.
Not your thing.
No, I'm a South African. My mm-hmm. entire being is shaped by that I have to own that I have many memories that are great at the expense of other people. I'm not saying that it's like, woe is me. I'm aware of that. So my Braaiplaas rugby, sunny skies and Chevrolet memory comes at the expense of someone else. I mean, I met somebody. That's also what I love about this country. I'm trying to remember his name now because I stayed up late last night and I'm getting older and one forgets. He was like a hardcore liberal in the DA, a black DA member. And I'm driving the car with him in Limpopo. And he's my age. And I say to him, and he says to me, so I grew up in Soweto seeing bodies burning in the streets. So I say, well, my memories are Braaiplaas, rugby, sunny skies and Chevrolet at your expense. And he said, oh, get over it. I'm fine. Don't like make out as if, you know, your wonderful childhood is at my expense. I survived it. I'm okay. So I turned to him and I said, one thing, you had a mom who loved you, didn't you? And he said, yes. I said, well, that's what protected you. That is what has enabled you to not allow that to damage you.
And nobody talks about this, but the role of black fathers is something that is a very touchy subject that we don't uncover often enough. And it's the cause of a lot more pain and misery in so many people in this country than people are willing to acknowledge.
Well, I don't know. My dad was German, so...
No, but I'm saying for a lot of young black people in South Africa. And a lot of this anger and frustration with the tertiary education and with all of these systems about families.
Well, if you look at Juju and Zuma, that's a classic Oedipal thing that's playing out. I mean, Julius Malema grew up without a father. If you read his book by Fiona Ford, I don't know if you've read it.
The ANC was his family.
Absolutely. And he did amazing things. He never humiliated himself when he was hungry. He'd hang out at someone's house because he knows in an African household, if you're serving like food, you've got to feed everybody who's there. You don't like run away into the bedroom and eat. So he'd never be somewhere where he'd had to ask for food. Somebody would say, oh, dude, you come and eat. So this thing, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how he feels when he has killed the father he needs to kill. Who is metaphorically, of course, please, metaphorically.
Yeah.
And I find it really interesting to see how that's playing itself out and how angry the president is at this amazing thing that's going on in parliament.
He's very angry about it. I love the way he casts himself as a victim.
Mm.
But didn't your dad do that too? He was like, well, you know, we lost, and you say he admired the British, but he was bitter.
I don't think he was bitter. I think he was just sad. I think there's something about when you don't engage with what's happened, you lose your Heimat. He lost the homeland that he grew up in. He went back to it. He didn't go back to it for a long time. His sister stayed there and she rebuilt it. I mean, Berlin was, you know,
ashes.
Aleppo. And so I find that really interesting that he didn't go back there. He didn't help his sister, didn't help his mother stay. Because my dad was a wussy. He's like a mommy's boy. He was looking for like the, you know, and he was good looking. So he hung out in England, you know. I only found out just before he died that he actually was married before he married my mom. And he was married to a woman called, how can I forget? She played Lady Penelope in the Thunderbirds. Sylvia Anderson.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she was Sylvia Tam before that. And I couldn't put it in because I found her daughter. She was a British woman who married my father because he was in the prison of war camp, and British women were not allowed to marry Germans. They weren't allowed to fraternize. But you can imagine all these women seeing these gorgeous German men in their suits being marched off to church from the prison of war camp. And so they got married, but they weren't married for long. So, I asked him about that when I went through his papers and I saw previous marriage annulled. What's this?
This is a fascinating story in so many ways because there are obviously parallels between the journey. They're not the same, but there's a parallel between the kind of experience your dad had and his experience with fascism and then his... I don't know whether he ever found liberation.
I think he did. He found it because he was... I think you need to prod people into thinking through where they are. My mother grew up under Salazar, who was also a dictator. Both of them, interestingly enough, Salazar and Hitler were born in the same month, same year, and the Gestapo trained the P-Day. So my mother's brothers, two of them were communists and were arrested. And it's interesting because last night somebody said to me, often Portuguese people of that generation don't speak. I mean, the P-Day absolutely terrified the Portuguese population because your next-door neighbor was a pimp. They'd say, you know, almost very much like the Gestapo. So those dictators, Hitler for my father, provided a sense of self and purpose, and Germany will be great again, and we will win, and, you know, we're great, we're fabulous. And for my
mother... Sounds a lot like someone we hear in America right now.
Absolutely. And for my mother, fascism just made her small, disappear. Don't talk about Verwoerd in this country. It's not our country. They're going to lock you up. I don't want you to be locked up. I don't want you to be hurt by the politics. Be silent. Don't speak. Don't speak. And then she had a stroke and lost her voice, so she couldn't speak.
Such an irony.
Absolutely. Incredible. I could never get to the story, ever. I mean, I think I'm related to half of Portugal. She had like five brothers, and they're all called Manuel or Fernandes, and, you know, so...
You'll never know.
Now, when you write to Portuguese people from South Africa, they're all, no, we don't know them because they think we want money. It's Africa. If somebody from Africa is writing, we don't want to know. What do you want? They want money. Don't ask them.
And your dad's German family, any connection
his
there
sister,
again?
Yes, his sister's in Berlin. She's still alive, Tante Tutte, who actually I found out also knew,
her,
knew the Goebbels. Do you know that?
She knew the Goebbels.
Well, just, you know, I tell you, my karma is so awful, I don't think you want to sit in the same studio as me. Because not only was my father that far away from Adolf Hitler, not only did he calibrate the machines that made the first trigger for the first R1 in South Africa that he handed to Verwoerd.
He was like his munitions man.
As he was telling me this, I was just like, ah. Then a book arrived from Germany called Der Kinder der Reichskanzler. So my dad says, oh, this book has come this weekend from my sister from Berlin. It's about the Goebbels family. And it's by their nanny, Hubi. Very nice people, the Goebbels is, huh? And at the back, my aunt put a picture in of her and Hubi. The nanny of the Goebbelses.
Oh, my God.
Like outside a block of flats in Berlin, 1932, who knows?
But this is what, you see, this is why I love when people go into their family history. You find that you're actually only a few steps away from either nasty dictators of the worst order or really interesting historical characters.
In my case, they were all on the wrong side of history, I'm afraid, on the German side.
This is like, whoa. But how fascinating to know that you have completely different ideology to all of them.
Well, that's what the book's about.
And your exploration of how you got to this point is fascinating.
You can get out of it. You can move away from any political system that tells you that you must hate others, that you need to just sort of, you're the dominant guys, that you must go for it.
So what is your take on nature and nurture?
I think nurture much more than nature. Nurture, I mean, if I've got a bad chest and a weak back, thanks to my dad, not a spine, I'm not spineless, weak back, weak chest, thanks to the genetics of my dad. But nurture, I think, you know, a child needs 5 years of intense giving them an internal object to hold on to. My mother created in me a panic room that is beautiful. I can go in there. My mother loved my brother and I mean, it's ridiculous. I got self-esteem from a Portuguese mother, which is outrageous. Luckily, my dad dented it, so it's like, you know,
you balanced a little more.
Well, I do think I'm a fraud most of the time. I think the cops are going to come and drag me out here and say, who's this idiot? You know, that's my dad. And the perfectionist in me is my dad. Because I'd mow the lawn, he'd come out and go, yeah, but you missed that corner.
And he
you
had
know?
Clocks and things all over the place, right?
Like measuring time. Yeah, time and the temperature, you know.
What is that with Germans? Because that's
control.
Also a stereotype. But
control. They're the ones with like germicides and the, you know, not germs as a house. We control the time and the temperature and then we make sure the world is... as we want it. Cut your hair, wear that, do this. Insane. They are afraid of the unknown. And people who are afraid of the unknown are very susceptible to religion and ideology, and it's dangerous. Because if you open it up, you realize everyone's like you. You know that there's an intrinsic need for all of us to be stripped of what history says we are, what politics says we are. And for me, ordinary South Africans... have showed me that.
How do you go about raising your daughters? Your two black daughters. you're a lesbian mom to two black daughters. Mm. And I just think there is so much that those people who want control will say is already not on their side. And yet, there's this opportunity for them to see and explore and understand the world afresh, anew, and without any of that pollution.
Well, I mean, the point is that the world comes at them as two young black women. And I'll give you an example of, you know, you cannot understand the extent of it until you see it happening in your own children. And when you're a mother, you're like a lion. Well, I'm like a lion. Don't go near my kids. And I went to a nursery school around the corner from where we live to see whether it was okay for my daughters. Because first of all, I wanted the teachers to be black. I didn't want just the cleaners to be black or the people in the kitchen. Because my daughters need to see a teacher income. I mean, we need to go to a black lawyer, black financial advisor, a black doctor. Because all of that matters.
It's a self-esteem thing for them. They've got to see black people in charge.
Particularly in Cape Town. My daughter said to me one day in the back of the car, she said, "Mommy, are there any poor white people?" So I said, "Yes, they are." And about 6 months later, she said, "By the way, when are we going to see this poor white person?" You know, and it's Cape Town. So I'll tell you about what happened at this particular school, because it really just awakened in me a sense of how the world comes at black people, and you don't know it until it happens. So I was with Layla, and we were there, and it was an open day, and my partner had hurt her back and couldn't bend, but she dropped a 5 rand coin because she was going to buy fudge and all sorts of stuff, and Layla bent down to pick it up. She must have been 3, 4. And this little old white lady came out from behind a tree, grabbed my daughter and said, "You give that money back to that lady." So that was one of, and the Pretoria girl in me wanted to take this old white lady's face and just pulpit on a wall, because that's me inside. But my partner's a shrink, and my don't touch me on my studio. I will murder you.
In this case, your children.
My children.
I got you.
And my partner, who's the sort of more balanced, actualized person, said, "No, that is our daughter." But I just thought, we can't be here. I can't be here. And why should my child be subjected to this? Why should my child become part of a collective because this person hasn't been able to work through her own shit? And that was one of many occasions. I mean, I walk into a shop with my kids at Woolworths, and they don't clock that I'm their mother. They're 13 and 11 now, and the security guards are on them. I mean, I could be strapped with dynamite from neck to ankles without disguising it. No one's going to look at me. That's a white lady walking into a shop. I'm not going to steal.
What about the hair thing with these schoolgirls recently?
Well, I was hardcore about my kids' hair. I didn't want them to straighten their hair. I didn't want them to do anything that would make their hair white, because I have a problem with that. So I've got it's difficult to teach your kids about Steve Biko when you're white yourself, but you can try, and negritude and Fanon, and but I want my children to locate themselves in Africa, in South Africa, and
but
understand.
But are these your wants? Because I'm sure you've been faced with these questions too by other probing outsiders who want to have a hand in how you raise your children.
Well, interesting enough, it's only about the hair that people have I was walking with Kenya, my youngest daughter, who's got Andile hair. She's got hair they're knickknacks. She just refuses to do anything with it, which I quite like. But I get looked at by black women. It's kind of like, this white woman does not know what to do with her child's hair. So I said to Kenya in Cavendish, I said to Kenya, "I'm not going to go out with you anymore because I get looked at in a particular way. Your hair is disgusting. You look like you slept outside last night." She said, "Well, I'm not going to walk with you in Cavendish because you ain't got no ass." And I ain't got no ass.
This is fascinating. That's German.
Yes.
Can't help that. Because
if
you had a little more Portuguese,
Better ass. Yeah. So, for me, it's just about dealing with these things as they arrive, teaching my children that this is what's happening, that they are viewed in a specific way. They've had to put up with lots of stuff. My first daughter has been clocked, but for some weird reason, as colored in Cape Town. I didn't expect that at all. And that has come with its own set of really weird circumstances, where kids who are colored themselves with straight hair will tell her at school that she's got an afrola. Now, children are sociopaths.
What's that?
Afrola is a combination, let me tell you, only a little sociopathic child could make that up, of Ebola and Afro.
Oh, that's horrible.
Isn't that disgusting?
But
it's just little shits. So when she came home and said to me, "Mom, you told me black people can't be racist." So I realized, okay, here we go. Why? She said, "Well, because somebody said something to me at school today that I think might be racist." So I said, "Okay, well, you tell me and then we'll work it out and see." So she said, "Well, this guy said to me that I have an Afrola." So I said, "Huh?" And she said, "It's a combination of Afro and Ebola. Because he's got straight, sleek hair, you see. Okay. So that's hair's a big thing." So I said, "Well, did you think it was racist?" And she said, "Yes, I do think it's racist." So I said, "Look, we could go there and I could confront him and his parents as a white person with a sense of agency about their black racism, which is going to get very complicated. Or you could tell him that he was racist and see what he does, because he's your age." And she said, "No, I think I'd rather do it."
Yeah, she wants to keep you out of it. She also knows what her mum does for a living.
Yes. And but I love the fact that my children can confront this themselves, but after consultation. Because my youngest daughter also said that a child in her school said to her the other day, "Yeah, but you're going to get into the school you want to go to and you're going to get a bursary because you're black." And I said, "Huh? What did you say to her?" She said, "No, I mean," she said, "I ignored her because I know it's because I'm good." So
well,
that's
the beginning of something powerful.
So there's something, but she recognized what this child said, who must have heard it at home, that the only reason Kenya's going to get into the school is because she's black and she's going to get a bursary. Although, actually, we got into every school we applied for because diversity just went middle class, white people can pay school fees with black children, very good, let's let them in, yes, 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 let them come.
Yeah, you're top of the pops.
Oh, top of the... Got in everywhere. Every school we went to, we just like got in. Like the, and then, of course, mothers would say things. We'd have such fun at the nursery schools because like one day, I'd fetch one day, other mom, and then the mums would say like, so do you like guys like share everything? Like one of you comes one day and one of you comes the other day. I said, yeah, it's amazing. Like one of us opens the fridge and there's no groceries in it. And one of us goes out and buys it. Not one of us goes to play golf the whole weekend or hang out with the boys. Like, whoa, it's just a household. Major cosmopolitan sex, like 5 nights a week.
Yeah, well, you got the double whammy. You got the black children and the lesbian.
Totally.
I mean, it's just too much for some people.
Can you imagine my kids' therapy with two mothers? Like you usually have to go deal with one mother.
Here's what I'm going to bet on, and this will upset people who think that the other stuff matters. I'll bet that your kids end up a lot more self-actualized than a lot of kids who grew up with those systems, because the system doesn't actually help the self. Very often the system just gives you a jungle gym to swing on, but it doesn't help you figure out who you really are. And you said it when you were talking about that DA guy you were driving around with, and he said, get over it. He had a loving mom, and he acknowledged that. This is at the center of everything. If there is real care and real effort put into raising children, and there's so many parents who just don't do that, on all fronts, there are rich people who don't, there are poor people who don't, there are black people who don't, there are white people who don't, just do not raise kids properly. And if we had healthier parent-child relationships in South Africa, I think we'd have happier intergenerational everything.
I think it's just about. Also, I'm an older mother, so my children weren't an invasion in my life. I think if you're going to have kids, you have me time from 0 to like 20 something. After that, no more me time. I don't want to hear you need me time. Yeah. No, when you have children, there's no me time. Don't moan, don't whinge, get on with it. They need you. You'll have me time again one day when they're gone, and they go very quickly. So for me, I don't know. They've taken me into landscapes that I never thought I had. You don't need a ticket. You don't need to pack a bag. And it's been frustrating at times as well. But,
so what kind of – because you don't sound at all pessimistic about their future. What kind of a South Africa do you think they'll grow up in?
Well, already, first of all, I was saying to somebody last night, we were in the middle of a civil war. So the thing about being older is that you were there. Mm-hmm. And you're now here, so you can tell the difference, and you can see when something is happening, what the context is, which is why I think people find some of the writing in the Daily Maverick speaks to them. But it's just because we're older and we can see the context of what's happening, and we can join the dots in a way that's difficult. Because when I was 19, 20, 21, I couldn't do it, and I say that in the book. We just reported on what we saw. I couldn't interpret it. South Africa's been 5 minutes to midnight since that boat landed in Cape Town in 1652. And we've always made it. And there's been a lot of pain, and there's been a lot of displacement. There's been a lot of stuff that we need to fix. But I'm really optimistic. And I don't know whether that's just me, the survivor, but when I look at the station, I look at who works here, I look at the things people are creating. Look, politics gives us one little dirty window into the world. Yeah. But compared to Europe, I mean, look at what's just happened at these local elections.
Yeah.
Two young leaders of opposition parties, and we all thought the EFF was going to like do well, but the DA did well. Because you like to diss the DA. Oh, it's a white body. But suddenly, like, a whole lot of people voted for the DA. South Africans, we chucked stones before when you don't deliver. We, you know, I always like to quote Marx, not Karl Marx, Groucho Marx. And Groucho Marx said this wonderful thing. Who are you going to believe, me or your eyes?
There we go.
And that's us. We're not stupid.
What do you think of what's going on in America?
I just actually haven't, because last night I wanted to watch, but
yeah,
I thought
it's 3 in the morning.
It's at 3 in the morning, and I don't know if I think this contest, this political contestation, where you have, political magpies, where people just make it up as they go along. It's a post-ideological age, and so people like that rise to the fore. And I think the Americans should look at why Trump has got as far as he's got. I'm a Bernie Sanders person, I have to say. I'm one of those idiot people. I believe in sort of democratic socialism. I'd like us all to have a house, all to have a car. I don't want some people to have a 95 million rand house and 5 cars in the driveway. It's too much. too much. Give it away. Everybody must eat. You know. Anyway, so I'm not quite sure what's happening in America. I think it's going to affect the rest of the world. I think the geopolitical plates have shifted massively since 2008. We're all living through something that we don't know. It's a post-ideological age. It's all about money, and it's all about markets, and it's about a growing elite and an increasing. So there's a.
What do you make of the symbolism of Hillary? I mean, because there's a lot about her that isn't necessarily about the person. It's about being the first female president of the United States, potentially. It's about being Bill's wife. It's about being a strong woman who's able to...
You know who I'd like to see right now is Michelle Obama.
Yeah, me too. No, for sure.
All bread dollars. But because there's something about Hillary as part of that dynastic element to American politics. Yeah. The Bushes and the Clintons. And there's something quite malevolent about it.
But if you had Michelle, it would be a new dynasty, that's all.
It's true. But I would imagine it would be a kinder dynasty. Look, the thing about American politics, it's a two-horse race, and it's about lobbying, and it's about capital, and that's the system. You know, that's what you're voting for. And I mean, it's interesting because crime is the flip side of capitalism. Crime and violence. And if you put on American television, it's so interesting. I mean, if you just don't look, all you hear is screaming, women screaming and sirens. They're mad people. Guns.
Yeah.
Lunatunes, you know.
You say crime is the other side of capitalism.
Yes, crime is the flip side of capitalism. On the one hand, I wouldn't have a security gate, cops, judges, lawyers, what's it called, satellite tracking companies, I mean, VAT on, you know, if there wasn't crime. So, but I think crime is as a result of people not having access to markets. So, you know, I don't earn a salary. I haven't since 1997. And for FNB, I own a house in Newlands. FNB won't lend me money. So, I mean, it was funny because somebody was saying on the Daily Maverick the other day, who funds these journalists at the Daily Maverick? My overdraft funds me.
Yeah, that's scary.
I'm not Cliff. I don't have the brand kind of like, I'm Portuguese. Please. My calculator is always minus.
How do you think I built this?
Exactly. My calculator. Overdraft. Absolutely. My calculator is always minus. I don't like, I owe SARS money and I owe like my credit card.
Yeah.
You know, so it's the economy, stupid. You know, and I think if you don't have access to the economy and you want to survive, you have to break the law. There is a part of me that is a Pretoria girl that thinks, shit, I should hydroponically grow weed. I mean, that's going to like...
My buddy will be buying into that.
I'm all for
that. Hey, I mean, the poorer in me wants, you know, vegetables. How much I'm going to sell those wilted cabbages.
But the German in you must think that this is terribly irregular. And
yeah, and Dach is not good for you because it makes you like, hey, I've got plans. You never really actually do it. Yeah. But
what do you do if your daughters come home and they want to smoke weed?
I will talk to them about these things. I did take them to Forries down the road and say to them, sweeties, this is a straight pub. Did I tell you? I don't think I've written the book about my youngest daughter discovering what the word gay means.
Yeah, how did she figure that out?
Well, it was so wonderful because Mark Lottering is a dear friend of mine. And just before that, Rhoda Cardale, who's also a friend of mine, daughter got married. I've known her daughter Julia since she was a baby. And it was quite a big wedding.
She got married to a girl?
No, she got married to a boy. And it was like an Orthodox Jewish wedding set on a Cape Flats sort of setting. So it was lovely. It was kind of very, and it was at Leonhof. And my daughters were like bridesmaids, and they like the whole, because that Disney stuff seeps through the walls whether you like it or not.
Sure,
you know, like white weddings, and you cannot keep it out. But so anyway, about 3 weeks later, Mark Lottering phones and said to me, listen, you might have Layla and Kenya like flower girls at my marriage. I'm getting married to Anwar, his partner. So I said, no, absolutely, I'll ask them. Layla, my older daughter, generous, kind, totally. Kenya. I said to her, so listen, Mark and Anwar are getting married. Do you want to be a flower girl? She said, Mark and Anwar. So I said, yeah. She said, but like, they're both guys. So I said, Kenya, Mark and Anwar are gay. She said, Mark and Anwar are gay? So I said, Mom and I are gay. She said, what? And I said, and she said, who else is gay? And I said, Tom and Renee and so and so and so and so. And so she said, do we know anybody who's straight?
The horror.
So I realized you can use a word around children and think they just know what it means. So she said, absolutely not. I'm not going to be a bridesmaid at a wedding between two men. We should like all of nine, you see. So I said, well, fine, you little homophobe. Go to your room. That's okay. Think about that. You don't have to. So eventually, I think, now I must ask her why she says this. So I go back into the room and I say, Kenya, why What is it? What's going on in your head about this two men getting married? Do you think one of them is going to wear a dress and it's going to be like really weird? And I realized she had nothing to hook her. She had nothing, you know. So of course she gets there and it's like Guess jeans and like Gucci sunglasses and celebrities, and she's like full on in front. Like yeah, definitely.
So now
there.
She's loving it.
No, well, Kenya, who I wanted to have be a socialist and a politician, is like a top billing person. She keeps on saying to me, "We don't live in a top billing house." I said, "We're never going to live at a top billing house. We're socialists." And then she says to me, she's never going to vote for the DA. So I said, "Oh, really? Why is that, Kenya?" She says, "Well, because it's a white party, all of 11. So I said, where did you hear that? You've been seeing Muzi Maimane in Parliament. So she says, "Yeah, no. So I said, "You know, you, when that Maserati passes us in Cape Town and when we drive past top billing houses, I see your little eyes light up, Kenya." She says, "Yes." So I say, "Well, you are a DA voter." Furious with me. She thinks I voted for Julius. I said, "I don't vote for any of them." So these conversations happen, and then she put a post up in the house saying, "Vote Kenya, she's awesome," and I said, "That's good enough for
me. That'll work.
That'll work for me.
I like the name."
It's they've got sort of middle names that I hope are going to like mean something. I mean, Marianne was the leader of the French Revolution. I didn't know that.
Did your dad choose that?
No, I think my mom and dad sort of compromised on it. My mother had an aunt called Marianne, and my dad Marianne. So yeah, that's. Those are my names. I don't think it's going to mean anything. But I'm very optimistic about South Africa because I think South Africans understand our democracy. We're fighting for it. I think you can see that in the election results. You can see it in the court cases. I don't think we should be afraid of that a group of people want to hijack the economy. It's what happens.
Well, they can try. But I think we've won before. We'll win again.
That's what I feel. Right? That's what I feel.
And do you think that this is exactly the right time for people to start confronting all these issues that have held us back for so long? I mean, it only 100 years ago did women first get the vote. It's frightening to think that. Mm-hmm. And look how far we've come. Only,
it's fantastic.
Only 22 years ago did we in South Africa give everyone here the vote. Mm. But it's amazing how much can happen in this short time. And we never take stock of the good.
We have so much freedom. We have so much freedom. You know, I went to a press conference where the Minister of Police and the Minister of State Security were giving a really bizarre press conference about the Hawks, about to arrest Pravin Gordhan. I haven't been to a press conference with the Minister of State Security and Police since the 80s, okay? So
yeah.
I come from that shit place. And I sat there and these young journalists around me gave these ministers such a hard time. I mean, one of them just said, "Minister Mkhleko, how can we believe you? You delivered the Nkandla report." I mean, and someone else, I just turned around and I thought, "But are you guys, they're going to like, these guys are going to like put a baboon fetus in front of your house and poison you?" But no.
That's what used to happen.
That's what used to happen. And you would never have dared
care about history enough. And if they don't care about history enough, they don't know what to compare it to. Like your daughter didn't know what gay was.
Yes.
We've got to realize how far we've come.
We've come out huge. I mean, I love where we live. And I love the fact that I can write every day what I write without anybody. They might be listening into my phone, but that's fine. But I don't feel under threat. I don't feel that I'm going to get arrested and detained. There might be other people who do in townships who are much closer to the action. But people have got electricity. People have got water. People feel that they own our country. There is a tremendous sense of possibility. And I think South Africans are hugely resilient. And if you come to Joburg and you see the building and you see what people are creating and you see the books we're writing and you see what the students are saying, that's not happening anywhere else, nowhere else in the world. And I'm really optimistic about that.
Well, listen, your book is fantastic. It's called Hitler, Verwoerd, Mandela and Me. It's a memoir of sorts by Marianne Tam. You must get it and you must read it, and it will improve your life.
Thank you, Cliff.
Really good.
Thank you.
You even go into... your dad's name was Georg.
Georg. Yeah. Oh. My mother was Barbara. She used to bargain for my stuff, bargain for my clothes and all sorts of stuff. But Cliff, I appreciate it.
What a story. No, what a pleasure to have you here. Thank you, Marianne.
Thank you.
All right, let's wrap it up with some un-news. Here's what you need to know. Americans are currently taking stock of the Clinton-Trump debate. Many backing Crooked Hillary as the winner. Donald naturally disagrees with this and would like another debate immediately to debate who won the first debate. In other news, the Fees Must Fall movement seems to have hit a bit of a stalemate, with neither side looking like they're going to budge. The government are thinking that celebrity endorsements are the way to go, and are considering booking black coffee to go to campuses and try to reason with the students. If his words don't do the trick, he could always just clap them. Alistair Coetzee says all is well in the current Buck camp and that he has full faith in his coaching staff. He went on to say that the test match this weekend against the Wallabies will be very tough as the team is lacking confidence right now, and his coaching staff have no idea of how to change this. Woohoo! All right, we will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. Have an excellent day. Take care of yourselves. Kat and Ari on the way. And we'll see you then. Bye-bye. Blah, 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 blah.
This is CliffCentral.com.